Good.
How's it going? How's your spring?
Good.
I emailed you about the media site not working.
It's working now.
Is it? Okay, and I checked this morning as well, but it's been like 3 hours since I checked now.
No, it's working for me. So are you sure it's something on your side? Because I checked.
So it's working for all my other classes. And for equity valuation from NYU classes, like, it's just not there. The links, like, the media site is just not there under all the list of links.
Yeah, NYU classes is down.
But even from your website, then, when I click on it, like, you know, /NYU under the podcast, the video.
I'll have to check, because it looks like it's
gave me a 404 not found yesterday and today. So.
Okay, I'll check.
Okay, thank you.
So who are you doing? What company? Norwegian what? Okay, folks, welcome back. Whether you want to be back or not is a different question, but okay, couple of things. One is that the second half of the class is officially kicking off right now. I did keep my promise, though. I sent only one email for the entire, you know how much restraint I had to show to do that? Every day I said, I have to send an email today. I restrained myself. So I stayed away for a week, but I'm going to make up for it this week. A couple of things before we start. One is your discounted cash flow valuations. If you want me to give you feedback, are due by this Friday. Don't act all surprised. It's been coming at you for the last 5 weeks. I've been telling you this. It's not for grading. I'm going to give you some instructions. I'll send you an email today about what I want you to submit, but it's very simple. I want you to submit the Excel spreadsheet that contains your discounted cash flow valuation. No text, no. But I did make a big deal about stories, right? I said you have to put your stories into the spreadsheet. You know what I mean by that? You put a revenue growth number, whether you like it or not, you're telling me a story. You give me a target margin, you're telling me a story. Put your story right next to the input. So when I said revenue growth is, and I'll give you an example with Snap of how I did it, right? When I told my Snap story, I sent this little picture of, hey, here's how my story connects to my growth assumptions, my margin assumptions, my cost of capital assumptions. Okay. And if you don't think you're telling a story, guess what? You are telling a story. Because when I look at your spreadsheet, I'm going to read your story back to you. And you say, I don't recognize that story. That's your problem, right? Because you've sent me. Because when you send me numbers, whether you like it or not, you're telling me a story about your company, and I want you to think about what that story is and kind of put it down. So I'm not looking for something elaborate. Your story could be, as I said, something you tell your elderly aunt at Thanksgiving, and she gets it, right? So keep it simple, keep it focused, and try to connect it to your inputs. Okay? Let's start today's session off with a couple of pieces about today. We're actually going to start valuing things. Up till now, we haven't actually valued anything to completion, right? We did the equity risk premium, the cash flows, the cost of capital, but in bits and pieces, today we're going to kind of remedy that by kicking into valuation full time. So here's a question that I think applies to every one of you, because you're going to be turning in a DCF this Friday, right? In the DCF, you're going to discount the cash flows, you're going to come up with the value. So let's say I did this for 3M. I discounted the cash flows. I came up with the value 150. My question is purely a question of timing. What exactly is this value as of? Is it as of right now? Is it as of a year from now? Is it as of the start of the calendar year? This calendar year, which would be 2017. Or maybe it's the start of the next calendar year. So when you do a discounted cash flow valuation, what time does that value go to? Do you see my question? You've done a DCF, you come up with a value per share. So what date is that value as of? What if your financials end December 31st of 2016? Is your valuation as of January 1st of 2017? If it is, you're in big trouble. You see why? Because let's say you found your company to be undervalued as of January 1st, 2017. What the heck are you going to do with it? You can't do time travel. Your discounted cash flow value is as of right now. You're saying, what do you mean as of right now? Whenever you get done with it. That's why you keep updating the numbers. Which also comes with some bad news then, right? Because when you turn in your valuation on Friday, you think you're done. But you're not. Why? The game continues, right? Things happen. Things happen where? They happen in the economy, they happen in the sector, they happen in your company. And when things happen, could your story change? In fact, one of three things could happen to your story. One is the most benign. Your story could change within the existing structure. So maybe you'll have higher revenue growth. So if you watch Snap, even in the last 10 days, people are starting to get more pessimistic about the future all of a sudden. Your story could change, but within the parameters of your old story. Your story could change because a company does something you never thought they would do. So Tesla announces that it's shutting down all its auto plants and making only batteries. Hey, your story now is a very different story. It's a story shift. Or your story could break. Pray and hope it doesn't happen. What could cause your story to break? Carolina, who are you doing? Valiant, right? What could cause a story to break? You just probably heard that Bill Ackman just sold his shares. If next week Valiant announces that they're now going to have an auction sale and liquidate everything they own, your story for Valiant is no longer of a going concern that can continue to produce cash flows forever. You will have to revalue it as liquidation, as the sum of its assets. I'll give you a couple of examples of how stories can break to show you how much things can change. I don't know whether you've heard of a company called Aerial. It's a company about 3 years ago that claimed to have found or come up with a technology that allowed you to stream cable channels onto your device, your iPhone or your iPad, without paying cable fees. Sounds too good to be true, right? Basically, you can watch all the cable channels on your iPhone or iPad without... They claim to have found a loophole in cable technology that allowed them to do this, and they said it's perfectly legal. Hey, if this works, it's an incredibly valuable technology, right? Because think of how much money you could make selling stuff to people who can now cut their cable wires and pay you $20 a month. The cable companies, of course, disagreed. So they sued. The suit made its way all the way. Aereo's value as a company increased about $1.5 billion because people thought this is a great technology, we can use it to make money. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. In the summer of 2014, the Supreme Court finally decided that what Aereo was doing was illegal. Next morning, guess what happened to Aereo? They shut their doors, the value went to zero. That's a story break. Here's another example of a story break. It's early 2015, you decide to invest in Ashley Madison. You know what they do, right? They're in the cheating business. A lot of cheaters in the world. You say, this is a big business, I want to be part of this business. The value of Ashley Madison rose as high as $1.5 billion. In March of 2015, that's what they were being valued by venture capitalists at. So you become an investor in the company. Then they had a little problem in April or May of 2015. Do you remember what the problem was? Somebody hacked into their computer, got the email addresses of every cheater they had on the computer, and they released it to the entire world. Now, this is not a good development if you're a cheating company. Cheaters don't like their emails known. Overnight, the value of the company went from $1.5 billion down to $300 million. You say, why did it stay at $300 million? There were actually some cheaters who view this as a badge of honor. I'm the biggest cheater of them all. Look, I'm on 16 lists. But the market's now shrunk. Your business has changed. And those of you who are valuing small biotechnology companies, this is always a clear and present danger that your story could break, right? You have this blockbuster drug working its way through the FDA approval process. You see a news story that says FDA decides the drug is too dangerous, pull it off the market, there goes your entire company. It can happen. It's not your fault. Don't come to me and say, oh my God, this has happened to me. Nothing's happened to you. Thank God you didn't invest real money in it. Value the company given what you know about the company and be open to the fact. I call this keeping the feedback loop open. Essentially, you got to keep information coming in so you can process it and essentially revalue the company. So all I'm saying is when you turn in your valuation on Friday, you're going to have a value per share. Be open to the possibility, much as you might dislike it, that that value can change between now and May 8th of 2017. May 8th, of course, is the date it's due. And when you finish your project and turn it on May 8th, I'll grade you on that project. But if you want to invest in this company, keep tracking the company because the value will change, the story changes, and the price will change with it. So let's say you come up with a value of 3M, $150 per share today. Right? If you feel confident in your value, right? What, am I missing a part of the question here? I think so. So I have to make up at the end of the question. What do you think I should make up as the end of the question? Okay, the end of the question is what would you estimate your value per share to be 1 year from now? You know why I ask you to do that? If you ever go to work in equity research, the practice there, instead of estimating value today, is to estimate a target price 1 year from now. So I'm saying, let's say you do discounted cash flow valuations. You come up with a value per share of 150, and that's of today. But your job requires you to put a target price a year from now. How would you come up with the target price? Come on, it's not that difficult. Let's say your cost of equity was 10%. What does that mean when you say cost of equity is 10%? That if the stock is correctly priced, you should make a 10% return on the stock, right? If the stock pays no dividends, let's make that simple. Let's assume stock pays no dividends. Stock is at 150 today based on your value. If your cost of equity is right, what should the value per share be 1 year from now? It should be 165. This isn't rocket science. So you can actually project out from a DCF what the value per share has to be 1 year from now, 2 years from now, three. And if the stock paid a dividend, what would you need to do? Subtract it or add it to the 165? You got a 50-50 shot. You need to make a 10% total return. Part of it comes from dividends, part of it from price appreciation. If the stock pays a dividend of $2 per share, your stock will go from 150 to 163, not 165, because you'll then make $13 from price appreciation, $2 from dividends. So whatever your stock is, once you value today, you have the flexibility of forecasting our target prices 1 year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. A final question. Right? Let's say you're valuing a high growth company, as some of you are. You're going to end up with cash, and let's say you project out the cash flows, you discount the cash flows back, you arrive at an equity value today of $100 million. So you've done the discounted cash flow valuation. The company has 10 million shares outstanding today. But do you think because it's a growth company, it will have to issue more shares in the future? And you're probably right, it will have to issue shares. Let's say 2.5 million more shares will have to be issued over the next 5 years as they grow. What value per share would you attach to this company? You see, the question I'm asking, the numerator is 100 million. Should I divide by 10 million, in which case I get $10 per share? Or should I divide by 12.5 million, which will give me $8 per share? Or it's going to be some number between 8 and 10, or some number greater than 10, or some number less than 8. I think that kind of covers all the possibilities. What do you think I should do? Yeah. You're on to something, but why am I not factoring in the dilution here? Because it is my share is worth less on a percentage basis if I bring the 2.5 million. You're right, they bring in the cash, and the cash is used to cover what? Why do they issue the shares? Why do you issue shares in general? Because you have a negative free cash flow equity, right? When I did my DCF, how did I get the value today? I discounted the cash flows back to today. And if I have negative cash flows to equity, the value today of $100 million is lower because of those negative cash flows in the next 5 years. You see where I'm going? The stock you're issuing is to cover those negative cash flows. If I count that in the denominator and I count the negative cash flows in the numerator, I'm in a sense double counting. One of the great things about discounted cash flow valuation is you don't have to factor in future stock issues because your discounted cash flow valuation already takes care of it. So in fact, when I valued Snap and I came up with the value of $14 billion, I know they will have to issue more shares in the future. It's a given. They have to grow so fast. But I don't have to worry about how many shares they will have to issue and at what price because my discounted cash flow valuation already reflects it. So let's start valuing companies. So turn to page 267 of your So before I start showing you valuations, let me set the table on some of the numbers you're going to see in these valuations. To value a company, you need a cost of equity. To get a cost of equity, you need an equity risk premium. Rather than with each company telling you where I get the equity risk premium, I'm going to set the table on how the equity risk premiums I've computed are going to change over time. So I'm going to show you valuations from 2006 and 2008 and 2010 and 2015. Here's what you're going to see. If I show you any valuations from before 1998, you're going to see an equity risk premium of about 5.5%. That's what I used to use as my equity risk premium then. Between 98 and September of 2008, you're going to see a risk premium of about 4%. This was a period where markets, the equity risk premium, the implied premium, hit 4% and stayed pretty stable. In the valuations I did after September 2008, extending into 2009, because the implied premium jumped, you're going to see my equity risk premiums be much higher in the valuations I did in 2008 and 2009. After 2009, I've actually become much more dynamic in the sense of whenever I do a valuation, the equity risk premium you're going to see, at least for a mature market, is going to be the implied premium for the U.S. market at the start of the month that I did the valuation. So when I valued Snap, I used a 5.69% equity risk premium because that was the premium at the start of the month. So as you see premiums change across the valuations, that's what's happened. And with each valuation, I'm going to try my best to tell you a story that frames my valuation so that you can see me try to value the company based on my story. And you can disagree with the story and say, what would I change if my story were different? But that's what I would. So don't get focused on a beta times equity risk premium. Think about the story. Think about the cash flows. Think about how the story connects to the numbers. So let's start easy, right? Let's make this the equivalent of training wheels. You want to learn ride a bike, might as well start with training wheels. Let's start valuing simple companies. So I'm going to start off by valuing Con Ed. You familiar with Con Ed? It's a regulated utility. Power in this room is supplied by Con Ed. It's a regulated utility in the sense that it's almost a monopoly. Almost all of the power, it's almost because now you can actually buy power from these small power companies, but 95% of the power for New York City, and that includes all the boroughs, though sometimes they forget Brooklyn, but that happens, comes from Con Ed. Okay. So as I go through this valuation, I'm going to first set up the process as to what kind of valuation model you're going to see here. It's a regulated utility. You're saying, what does that mean? When Con Ed wants to increase prices, they can't just increase prices. They have to go in front of a regulatory commission. And the regulatory commission actually decides whether they can raise prices. So they're a monopoly without pricing power. Okay. So I'm going to value it as a stable growth dividend with a stable growth dividend discount model, and here's why. First, if you look at what the company pays out, it pays out about 73% of its earnings as dividends. So it pays out a lot of its earnings as dividends. Why? Because it doesn't have very much in reinvestment. It knows what its earnings are going to be. Second, if you look at its growth rate, because I'm using a stable growth model, I have to make sure the growth rate I have is a growth rate that's less than the risk-free rate, right? Because you can't keep the growth rate going. So I took their retention ratio, which is 1 minus the payout ratio. So they're paying out 73%. They're retaining 27%. I've assumed the return on equity is equal to the cost of equity. And here's why. Here's how the regulatory commission decides whether you get a price increase. They look at your return equity. They have their own computation of cost of equity. And if you're making more than the cost of equity, they say you're making too much. Therefore, we're not going to let you raise prices. So almost the nature of regulation will almost force you to return equity equal to the cost of equity. So I'm going to assume that that's going to be true. 7.7% return equity said equal to the cost of equity. If you multiply the retention ratio by the return equity, I get an expected growth of 2.1%, which is much lower than the risk-free rate. So I'm okay with it. It's a growth rate I can assume forever. You're saying, why is it so much lower than the risk-free rate? Because Con Ed supplies power to the Northeast, which is a pretty, in terms of, because your growth of revenues, if you're an energy company, has to come from the population growing. If this were a mountain states energy company, because those states are growing faster, maybe you can have a higher growth rate, but this is a company that's actually going to grow far slower than the economy, 2.1%. And finally, I looked at whether the firm's risk and cost of equity are consistent with the stable growth firm, and its beta is towards the lower end, but that's pretty much what I'd expect with a regulated utility because you're starting to look a lot like a bond. So they have low growth, they're earning their cost of equity, and they have a cost of equity that is consistent with a mature company. So let me walk through the numbers. In the 12 months leading into August of 2008, their earnings per share were $3.17. So I used the trailing 12-month number. The dividends per share were $2.32. So that's what they earned in the most recent 12 months. If they're a stable growth company, all I have to do to value them is take the $2.32, which is what I made last year, grow it at 2.1% because that's what I expect the growth rate to be in perpetuity, divided by the cost of equity of 7.7% minus the growth rate. What I get as my value per share is $42.30. I'm done. Why? Because it's a boring company. It's a mature company. It's growing at less than the growth rate of the economy. It's paying out the bulk of its earnings as dividends. The one dangerous thing I've done is I've used dividends as a measure of cash flow to equity. So I did one final test. I computed their free cash flow to equity. Remember we said free cash flow to equity is what you can afford to pay out? Just to see if I was screwing up. And it turns out that they pay out 97% of their free cash flow to equity. This is one of those few companies that actually takes every dollar that it can afford to pay out and pays it out as dividends. So if I'd replaced the dividends with free cash flow to equity, I'd have got almost exactly the same value of equity for the company. So it's a very simple valuation. So imagine, you're probably saying, I wish I'd picked Con Ed. I could be done by now. You would be. Because all you need to know is dividends last year, growth rate forever, cost of equity, the value per share is done. But what are you learning about valuation? Not that much, right? Because it's just plugging into one very simple equation. But it works because it's a mature company that pays out almost all of its free cash or equity. You're saying that's not a very optimistic story you're telling about Con Ed. It's a realistic story. It might not be optimistic, but I don't see Con Ed becoming a 10% growth company. The growth is not going to happen because it's regulated. It's restricted from going into new businesses. Now, I'm going to use this valuation to kind of illustrate some very interesting things you can do after you're done with your valuation. The stock was actually trading at $40.76. Okay? So here's one of the questions you can ask. What would the growth rate need to be? You see what I'm doing? I have a growth rate of 2.1%, but that's my estimate. I could be wrong. The market has a lower value. What would the growth rate need to be for the value per share to be equal to $40.76? You can actually, in your Excel spreadsheets, use the solver function in Excel to solve for any of your inputs and say, what would that number need to be for my value per share to be equal to? I know somebody's valuing Tesla, and they emailed me, you know, a little forlorn this morning. Is Luis here? Oh, okay. And you said $16 per share, right? And you said there's something wrong with my numbers. Let's say you're done. You have no idea what's going on. You have $16 per share. The stock's trading at $260. You're saying something must be wrong here, right? Here's one thing you could do. Take your revenue growth number and say, what would the growth rate need to be? You have a growth rate, let's say 15%. What would the growth rate need to be? And you have to use a solver because otherwise it'll get really confused. What would the growth rate need to be for the value per share to be $262? You're going to come up with a growth rate. You're saying, what do I do with it? Let's say you come up with a 60% growth rate. This is the choice you face as an investor. I'm estimating 15. The market seems to think it's 60. I have to decide whether I could be that wrong on the growth rate or whether the market is wrong. Now, initially, you may say, well, the market knows better, so I'm going to push my... So you could actually make your value 262, right? Use the solver, then plug it in, tell me a story that you reverse engineered. I have no way of knowing. So I got exactly the stock price. I'll get a little suspicious if valuation after valuation, you tell me you got the stock price. But you can actually back out from the value per share, whatever the... that. But you can do it for only one variable. So in this case, it turns out that the break-even point is like 2%. What am I estimating? 2.1%. Could I be off by 0.1%? Absolutely. This is a stock where even though the stock looks undervalued, I'm so close to what the market is assuming that I'm going to step back and say, hey, this is a fairly valued stock. It looks like it's undervalued, but it's within the margin of error. So that's one way to turn your valuation around on its head and say, what would I need for my value to be equal to the price? Now let's take the second step, and this is something we did in the start of the class test. You've got 4230 as your estimate of value today, right? That's your DCF value. Your cost of equity is 7.7%, and you expect this stock to pay a dividend of $2.32 growing at 2.1% from now. So here's what you know. You have your DCF value, you have your cost of equity, you have your expected dividend next year. Using the process we just described for 3M, you should be able to tell me what the value per share has to be a year from now, right? Try it on your calculator. I think it's like $43.58 or something. It'll be the $42. It'll basically be the $42.30 growing out at 7.7% minus the dividend. Is everybody clear on why it's minus the dividend? Because part of your return comes from dividend. It's the remaining part that you have to get from price appreciation. So I can pull up the actual number because I have it in my notes here. I can't even pull up the notes page, never mind. It's a problem with using Mac Excel. I have no idea where the notes page is, and I'm not going to find out. Somebody can help me. 4230 growing out at 7.7% minus that dividend should be, I think, $43 and something. That is your target price a year from now. Stock right now is at 4076. So if I said, if you went out and bought the stock today at 4076, what will you make as a return over the next year? You're going to make about a 10 or 11% return. Is that enough on the stock? What does your cost of equity tell you? What do you need to make on the stock to break even? So if you can make 10 or 11% based on today's price, there's your buy. So whatever you do as a DCF, you can convert into an IRR, because some people, especially if you work with VCs and private equity investors, like to use internal rates of return. They say, this DCF stuff, I don't buy it. You can very easily convert your DCF into an internal rate of return and say, hey, you might not like my value per share, but how come, now why can't I give you an IRR, which you can now use for your decision making? Any questions on getting a target price and working backwards from there? So now let me start getting into some real valuations. Company I'm going to value is 3M. Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing. What does 3M do? Really boring things that make it a lot of money, right? Like that incredible advancement, the post-it note. You know how much money they make on post-it notes? In all the different colors? It's worth about $1.5 billion to them. The guy who invented that should get the Nobel Prize. That was genius, right? Sticky stuff. How come nobody thought of it until he came along? So they make stuff like that, tape. No, paper, using boring stuff. But they make a lot of money based on this. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to value 3M, and I'm going to value it just before the crisis hit. So this is going to be a moment of humility for me, because I'm going to show you the valuation in August, and then I'm going to show you the valuation in October of 2008. In August of 2008, I had no idea that the crisis was coming. Maybe you did, but I didn't. So I valued in oblivion. I said, no, it's the market, nice up, nice bullish market. Let me value the stock. So here's what my numbers look like. It's a company that generates a huge return on capital, about 25%. Why? Because they have patents on everything. You stick tape on something, you're paying 3M for that, right? So 25% return on capital, and they reinvest about 30% of their after-tax operating income every year to keep going. So if you look at the most recent year, the reinvestment rate is about 30%, and reinvestment is basically net capex plus change in working capital, where you divide by after-tax operating income. So if you keep those numbers going, they can expect to grow about 7.5% a year. So my growth rate is my reinvestment rate times return on capital. At the end of 5 years, I put them into stable growth. I gave them a growth rate in perpetuity of 3%. What do I check to make sure that the growth rate is not too high? What do I compare it to? I compare it to my risk-free rate of 3.72%. So I'm okay. 3% growth rate is fine. 3% forever. I was pretty conservative. I assumed that the return on capital would be equal to the cost of capital after year five. What am I assuming after year five? That those patents and excess returns, the competitive advantages would fade away, that they will earn their cost of capital. So these are the key assumptions. 7.5% growth for the next five. No excess returns after the fifth year. I projected out my cash flows, which is basically my after-tax operating income growing at 7.5% a year for the next 5 years. I'm subtracting out 30% of that as reinvestment. Notice I didn't even bother breaking it out into net capex and change in working capital, because that's a consolidated number. I already have the total reinvestment. I get the free cash flows. I discount them back at what I thought was a reasonable cost of capital, building off the risk-free rate. And the equity risk premium pre-crisis was 4%, so that was all feed in. I get a 7.88% cost of capital. You discount the free cash flows of the firm, and don't forget the elephant in the room, because beyond the fifth year, I have a terminal value. And this is, there's a mechanical question that I want to make sure that people get. When I do my terminal value, I'm going to use a 6.76% cost of capital, right? My cost of capital for the next 5 years is 7.88%. So here's my question. It's a purely mechanical question. Once I get this terminal value, what point in time is that terminal value at? What year is it at? At the end of year five, right? Not the end of year six, it's the end of year five. I have to bring it back to today. So I have to discount it. What discount rate should I use to bring the terminal value today? To compute it, I used a 6.76% cost of capital. What discount rate should I use to bring it back to today? Why 7.8? It's actually the right answer. Why should I use today the cost of capital during my high growth period?
Well, because the terminal value is at the end of year five. It's present value, so the time that has been going through is more like a risk year.
Exactly, right? So if you take Snap, for instance, my cost of capital up front is almost 12%. Eventually, when I make Snap a safe company, I give it an 8% cost of capital in year 10. You see why I have to discount it 12%? Because to get to year 10, what do I need? I need to live through the next 10 years. And the next 10 years are going to be rocky years with Snap. They're risky years. So I need to discount the terminal value back to today. Not at the 6.76% cost of capital. I used to compute it, but at the 7.8% cost of capital that they will have during my high growth phase. I add the present values together. The value that I get for the operating assets is about $60.6 billion. Remember, I valued only the operating assets. So I check for cash, and they have about $3.2 billion in cash. I subtract out debt. They have about $4.9 billion in debt. I get a value for the equity of $58.4 billion. Divide by the number of shares, I get a value per share of $84 per share. As we go through all of these valuations, the minute you see the value per share, what's the first thing you need to check? It's a publicly traded company, and this is all about making money, right? So you check the price per share. The price per share in August of 2008 was $70 per share. So ask me the question. You know the question I'm talking about? The question that will tell you whether I believe my own valuations. Did I buy it? Because I can give you one of three answers. I can say no, in which case, what have I told you about valuation? That I don't trust my own valuations, right? The second is I can say yes and lie. You have no way of checking. Or yes and buy. Half my portfolio is composed of stocks I've been trapped into buying because I get asked this question and finally I have to. In this case, I did buy 3M. Good investment, right? I did my valuation. I'm feeling pretty good about the valuation. It's higher than the price. And then you get September 12th of 2008. The world drops out from under you. You think, why didn't you see it coming? If I'd seen it coming, why would I be wasting my time on 3M? I'd be selling short on the whole market, making tons of money. The reality is nobody saw it coming. So don't listen to anybody say, even The Big Short, I saw it coming. I mean, you might have seen a small segment of it coming. Nobody saw it coming at that time with that much velocity. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to revisit my 3M valuation in October of 2008. I'll tell you before I even show it to you that I didn't do well on my 3M investment between August and October. The stock, I think, dropped from $70 to $57. Think, this is awful. You should get rid of the shares. But before I make that decision, I can't compare the $57 to what it was before. I have to revalue the company. I'll also tell you that between August and October of 2008, there was no new information from 3M. There were no new earnings reports. And one of the things that you'll often be told is the intrinsic value of a company will not change if there's no new information about the company. That is not true. What changed between August and October of 2008? You had a crisis, right? What does it mean when you have a crisis? The price of risk has gone up. Where? Both in the equity market and the bond market. The numbers I changed were risk numbers. My 4% equity risk premium, that's now history. The implied premium by the time I get to October of 2008 has gone from 4 to 6%. The default spread has increased to 1.5%. So the price of risk in both the equity and the bond market have gone up. With those higher prices built in, I get a 10.27% cost of capital. So just compare it. It was 7.88% before. It's now 10.27%. Here's the other thing that changed. It was not just the price of risk. Now you had a very real possibility that looking forward, you might have a recession, that this was going to push the economy into a recession. The way I showed that is when I projected out my return on capital, instead of using the 25% return on capital and the 30% reinvestment rate, I got more pessimistic on both those numbers. You're saying, are you allowed to do that? Of course you're allowed to do that. You are not stuck with using last year's numbers. Just because they reinvested 30% last year and made a 25% return on capital doesn't mean they will continue. So I basically became more, which pushed down the growth rate. Those are the three changes. My equity risk premium went up. My bond default spread went up. And my growth rate dropped. I revalued the company. Value that I got was 61. Do you remember what the value was in the previous iteration? It was 84. It's now become 61. It's almost fairly valued now, in a sense. I actually was right about going from undervalued to fairly valued. But I know I made no money. So the point I'm making is, just because you find an undervalued company and you're right about it being undervalued, doesn't mean you're going to make money, because there is this big market bet underneath that you don't control. In this case, I ended up continuing to hold 3M. It's still in my portfolio. You know what the value per share is today? 188 yesterday. So basically, I lived through, I could have sold. I could have panicked and said, October, it's gone. It's down $16. And that's the thing. That's what I meant by faith. Sometimes you got to hold on even though the price is down. It takes a lot of, you know, your ulcer. You might get ulcers. You might get stomach juices flowing. But you got to accept the fact that you don't control a lot of stuff in the market, and this is the way it's going to be. Any questions on the 3M valuation? So if you want to take a look at 3M, it's a fascinating company. It's a fascinating company that's fairly easy to value, because we know what it does. We know what its margins look like. It's a company that is relatively easy to value because so much of the company is known. It's easier to value 3M, obviously, than to value Snap. Right? No questions? Yes. That's actually a good question. Why do I need that valuation? I'm just curious. No. But there's a reason you asked that question, right? I need to have a valuation of about 180. Why? Because the stock is still in my portfolio at 188. Stocks have to constantly justify their existence, right? Just because it's gone up 300% doesn't mean it's a good stock today. So every year I actually have to revalue every stock in my portfolio. And if today I valued and came up with 150, what should I do? Sell the stock. There's a time to buy. What's it, a Kenny Rogers song? Know when to hold them, know when to fold them. And that problem with so much of investing is you're taught when to buy. You should buy now. Think of how little is ever written about when to sell. And part of the reason for that is people are told these crazy things like buy and forget it. Was that a good idea? If you bought because something was cheap, you should sell when that something becomes expensive. It's the same reason that I'm selling Apple at 140. It's done really well for me. I'm grateful to the company. But to hold on to an investment because it's done well for you in the past doesn't make any sense. So that's actually a very good question. I did value 3M at the start of this year. I get about 195, so I'm still okay with it. But I'm watching it. If it keeps going up and up and up and it goes shoot through my value, then it's time to leave. Any other questions? Okay. Now let's go from valuing a company to valuing an entire market. So one of the things you're all, you know, you'll hear discussions of is the market overpriced. And right now there seems to be a remarkable consensus that there's a bubble around us. It's just a question of time before the whole thing explodes on us. It's kind of scary even reading the Wall Street Journal nowadays. Because if you read it and you actually read the articles, you'd be selling everything and heading for the hills. You'd probably collect cash, put it in big bags, take it with you upstairs. Or maybe collect cash, convert it to gold, put it in gold ingots and take it up with you. It's a scary time. People are convinced that markets are overpriced. So you say, well, how do I decide whether that's true? Can you value an entire market? Sure. You buy the S&P 500, the entire index, you can ask exactly the same question that you asked about an individual stock. Is it cheap? Is it expensive? And that's what I'm going to try to do next, is I'm going to try to value the entire S&P 500. This is a valuation as of January 2015. But you can very easily update it to January 2017 or March of 2017. So January 2015, the index was trading at 2059. Right? So I said, let me try a dividend discount model. It's a simple model. Let's stay with the dividend discount model. The dividends paid in the most recent 12 months by all 500 stocks in the index was 38.57. That's actually just dividends paid on the index stated in dividend units. So that's what the dividend was last year. And the analysts were projecting a growth rate of about 5.58% in earnings. If I make the assumption that dividends are going to grow at the same rate as earnings, here's what I get as my expected dividend. So that's 38.57 growing at 5.58% gives me expected dividends for the next 5 years. Now remember, this is the entire S&P 500. I can't assume it can keep growing faster than the economy. So after the fifth year, I set the growth rate to 2.17. You're saying, where did that come from? It's actually just my risk-free rate. I'm assuming after the fifth year that my growth rate will become the growth rate of the economy, which I'm using the risk-free rate as my proxy. 2.17% forever gives me a terminal value of 1,011. Already I know I'm in deep trouble because the index is trading at 2059 right now. And I think it's going to be worth 1,011 in 5 years. By the time I'm finished discounting at the cost of equity, which is risk-free rate, and one of the nice things about valuing the entire index is you don't have to waste your time getting a beta, right? Because it's the entire market. The beta should be one. I end up with a value for the index of 895. So if I believe that value, what should I be doing? I should be selling all stocks and heading for the hills, right? But I can already tell you what the weakness of what I've done here is. I've focused on dividends as cash flows. And I think I've mentioned that U.S. companies increasingly, instead of paying dividends, do what? They buy back shares. So here's a very simple fix. I could take dividends and add the stock buybacks as well, saying that is what the entire cash flow is, not what you saw as dividends. That pushes up the cash flow from 38.57 to 100.50. Everything else in the model stays the same. And using that free cash or equity, I get a value for the index of 2,332. I personally believe that using dividends and buybacks is a more meaningful proxy because that's how companies return cash. It's kind of silly to focus on just the dividends. So if I look at dividends plus buybacks, it actually looks that there is some substantial upside left in the stock. The one final weakness in this valuation is where did I get the growth rate? From analyst projections of growth. So you're saying, what if they're wrong? So here's the final fix I made. Instead of using an analyst projection of growth rate, I use the same approach that I use to estimate the growth for a company, which is how much are S&P 500 companies reinvesting? They're reinvesting about 12% of their earnings. And what are they making as a return on equity? And collectively, they're making 16%. That drops my growth rate from 5.58% down to about 2%. And if I put that growth rate, value that I get is almost like 3% away from the index. So what does this all mean? In January 2015, after I worked through all these numbers, My reaction was, I'm not going to go crazy and buy the market, nor borrow money and buy the market. I'm not going to go crazy and sell off the entire market. It looks like the market is pretty close to where it should be, even if I use these internal, these fundamental estimates of growth. So that's what you could do today. I mean, the market right now is at 2,400 or whatever the S&P 500 is. You already have the buybacks. So if you go to my implied premium spreadsheet, I tell you what the dividends and buybacks were over the last 12 months. You can put in the growth rate. You can see if, in fact, the market is so hopelessly overpriced that these people keep claiming that it's a bubble. All right. But I checked the numbers out last week. I actually plugged the numbers in because after one particularly catastrophic, an article that claimed catastrophe was coming, it freaked me out. I said, I have to check. Maybe I should be selling all my stocks. And at least from my perspective, putting the numbers in, I can get pretty close to where the market is today. It doesn't mean the market can't drop. But if the market drops, it's got to be some fundamental breaking. Based on the fundamentals now, it looks pretty okay. So you can take any index and try this out. So you want to look at whether Indian stocks are undervalued, overvalued, take the Sensex, put it through this process. You want to see Chinese stocks are undervalued, overvalued, take the Hang Seng or take the Shenzhen and put it through the process, see what you get as a value. You can value markets just like you do individual companies. Yes? I do it, but I also tell you that I'm very bad at timing markets. So unless you get a freakishly big difference like I did at the end of 99, I got a freakishly big difference between the value that I got, the peak of the dot-com boom. The value that I got was about half of the price. That's probably one of the few times in my life where I've actually used market timing because I could not find a way to get to the market price. But generally, I don't have much faith in my own capacity because here's the way I think about it. If I don't bring something to the table, I shouldn't expect to take something away. With an individual stock, I could tell you all kinds of stories. Maybe I thought of this for Snap that other people didn't. But in the market, what am I going to think of that's so creative and unusual that somebody else hasn't thought about it? But at the start of every year, and I do it just at the start of the year, I don't revisit it. I do this check to make sure it's not outlandishly overvalued or undervalued. And if it looks within reason that you can explain it, I then move on to individual stocks. I do use it when I want to go into a market. Like when I went to Lagos, Nigeria, and I said, no, I had no idea what the Nigerian market was priced at. I did this for the entire Nigerian index to see if I could explain where the index was at. So for markets where I'm completely unfamiliar with the market, this kind of gives me a sense of how people are pricing that market. Nigeria actually, given the risk, I mean, companies are trading at 4x earnings. At first sight, I thought they must be cheap, but once I built in there, because they're a B2 rated country, so the default spread is 5.2%. The cost of equity in dollar terms is 18, 19, 20%. You put those numbers in, they should be trading at about 4x earnings. So it was good for me to have to look at those numbers, because otherwise I'd be jumping to conclusions about, hey, all Nigerian stocks look cheap to me. Okay. Any other questions? So now let's go to the dark side of valuation. This is one of my favorite titles. Of all my books, this is my favorite book simply because of the title. Okay? So let me explain what I mean by the dark side. Much of what we do in valuation was designed for money-making companies with a lot of history. Right? If I gave you a money-making company, a lot of history, like 3M, anybody can value that company. And by anybody, I mean, an 8-year-old could value that company. In fact, I'm not even sure you need a body. You could probably create an app or a spreadsheet that values every company. So I want to talk about when it becomes difficult to value companies. And I'm going to frame my arguments using the four questions I need answered to value any company. So when I look at a company to value it, there are four questions I need answers to. First, what are your cash flows from existing investments? So I'm looking at your 10K, your annual report. This is what I'm learning about your existing investments. Second question I'm going to ask you is, what is the value from future growth? For this, I need to project out where you're going to invest, what kind of returns you're going to make on that investment, and how much you will have to reinvest. Third question I'm going to ask you is, how risky is your company? And the fourth question I need to put closure is, when will your company be a mature company? Because that lets me come up with the terminal value. What are your cash flows? What's the value for future growth? How risky are you? When will you be a mature company? Here's the way I think about valuation. When those four questions are easy to answer, valuation becomes easy. Why was Conet so easy to value? Because I could look at the cash flows of existing assets, just looking at their financials. The value of growth was easy because they're, in a sense, constrained to earn their cost of equity. The risk is fairly visible because they've been around a long time. I can look it up with their history. And they're already a mature company. That's a slam dunk. The further away I get from that, and 3M was also pretty easy to value. I knew what they did. I knew their margins. I could look at their history. This is where modeling is all you need to value a company, right? Because if you can plug it into an Excel spreadsheet, you can project out everything you've done. So when will valuation be difficult? When you're valuing young companies. When you're valuing companies that don't fit the accounting mold. What do I mean by that? Accounting, as we know, it was designed for the old-time manufacturing company, right? Valuing technology companies, pharmaceutical companies is difficult, partly because the accounting doesn't make sense and you've got to fix it. And valuing companies becomes more difficult when you face significant truncation risk. What am I talking about? What does truncation risk mean? That your company might not make it. If any of you are valuing distressed companies, where you're saying, will my company make it through next year? Your discounted cash flow valuation just became a lot more difficult because there is truncation risk. You're valuing a Venezuelan company and you're worried about nationalization risk. It's much more difficult to bring in those risks. So I'm going to take the rest of the valuation examples you're going to see are going to be on the dark side, because I'm going to assume that if I gave you a money-making company, that you can pretty much deal with it. It's mechanics. You go to the right page in the spreadsheet, you put the equations in, everything's going to work out. So I want to focus in on difficult-to-value companies, because if you can value difficult-to-value companies, you can always value 3M. So let's start this process off by looking at the range of companies that we're going to look at. So I'm going to start off by looking at companies across the life cycle. Today I'm going to talk about valuing young growth companies. So for those of you who are valuing young growth companies, today I'm going to give you the template that I would use to value young growth company, the challenges you will face in answering the four questions. Then we're going to move to mature companies, which are normally easy to value, but mature companies that are facing midlife crises. Basically, these are companies where the way you've done things is no longer working, you're going to change. And therefore, valuation becomes more difficult because you're planning to change. Then I'm going to look at what are probably the most depressing companies to value, which are companies in decline. I don't know how many of you are valuing brick-and-mortar retail companies, but the more you look at them, the more difficult it becomes to tell an optimistic story. Why? Because there is no optimistic story. Amazon is eating half your lunch. Walmart and Target are eating the other half of your lunch. You're going to go hungry for a while before you starve to death. It's the way it is. So we'll talk about the challenges of valuing declining companies. Then I want to talk about valuing emerging market companies. What makes them so challenging? Why was PZ Cousins Nigeria so much more difficult to value than 3M? It has financials. It has an annual report. Why couldn't I just do what I did for 3M? Then I want to talk about companies in specific sectors that can be difficult to value. I'm going to start out with financial service companies, a sector where I thought valuation was easy. But those days of innocence are gone. I recognize very quickly the implicit assumptions I made and why valuation has become more difficult. I want to talk about commodity companies and cyclical companies. You have to value Royal Dutch. What are the special challenges in valuing commodity companies? And finally, I want to close off by looking at pharmaceutical technology companies with intangible assets. So with each one, here's what you're going to see. I'm going to go back to the four questions and talk about why those four questions are difficult to answer, and then we will kind of dig in from there. So let's start off with young companies. Okay? I'll make a confession. I love valuing young companies. Perhaps I'm strange. I find them fun to value. So I'll take you how I got to that point, because it wasn't always that much fun. Ready? I want you to play the role of an entrepreneur. You have a startup. And I'm going to come to you with my four questions, and you're going to see very quickly why valuing young companies is going to be difficult. Ready? You have a very promising startup. What are your cash flows from existing assets? What existing assets? You probably don't even own the chair you sit in. So that was easy. You're worth nothing. Then I ask you, what's the value of future growth? You say a lot. Can you be more precise? You don't even have a product yet or a market. So how risky are you? Very. You can't show me a beta. You can't show me past data. And I say, when will you be a mature company? You fall out of the chair laughing because you don't even know whether you'll make it through this evening. Young companies are difficult to value because those four basic questions become much more difficult to answer. And in fact, let me load up the dice. Let's say you're a young company with all of these problems. And let's say every other company in your business looks just like you. They're all young companies. This is what I call the valuation trifecta, where everything starts to blow up on you. And here's why. When you value a company, there are three places you go to get information. You start with the current financials. You dig through it looking for data. Then you look at comparable companies to see what it looks like when companies become more mature. And then you close the process by looking at maybe sector averages or the company's own history going back in time. So you start with the current financials, you look at the company's history, and you look at the sector averages. One by one, let me knock your crutches out. You're a young company. What do you not have? You have no history, right? You're a young company early in the life cycle. When I look at your financials, what do I find out about you? Not much, right? I can't read your margins because you didn't sell much. So you have no history, no financials. I said, that's okay. I'll go look at what more mature companies in your business look like. But what did I just say about the other companies in your sector? They're all just like your company. They're all young companies. This is when the dark side will beckon. You'll say, you know, that intrinsic value stuff doesn't work. The rules don't apply here. It's been a paradigm shift. And here are the manifestations that you're on the dark side. And watch for these next time you watch CNBC and you see an analyst talk about a young company. The first is you will see words like paradigm shift, a new world order. The old rules don't apply, which basically means the guy has no idea what's going on. He's just making up stuff as he goes along. The second is you will see metrics that nobody's ever seen before. Things like, they have no earnings, no revenues, but I can tell you value per user or value per subscriber or value per download. And finally, you'll see a lot of macro stories. What do I mean by macro stories? I still remember the first time when Facebook went public. Now, and I did a valuation of Facebook, and they put me on CNBC with a Facebook analyst who was very bullish on Facebook. And I remember asking, why are you so bullish? What do you like about the company? And he said his daughter was on Facebook 16 hours a day. I said, okay. Is your daughter spending billions of dollars? Is it something I don't know? But he wanted me to extrapolate from that. His story was, look, my daughter's on Facebook 16 hours a day. That must mean everybody's daughter is on Facebook 16 hours a day. And you multiply that by the number of daughters around the world. That's a lot of people in the world. So that's the kind of macro story that they want you to go with because they don't have specifics. If you don't believe me, just watch on CNBC and you look at people trying to justify the valuation of a Snap. There are ways to justify the valuation, but pointing to social media being the reason is not a good way to do it. But that's the dark side. When I used to do these sessions in the 1990s, the sector that I've just described was actually the dot-com sector, right? It's the social media sector. In the late 90s, this is what the dot-com sector looked like. Every company was a young company, losing money, very little history. And the dark side beckoned. I would do these sessions on discounted cash flow valuation and intrinsic value. And towards the end of the session, somebody in the audience would come up to me and say, you really cannot value Amazon.com using a discounted cash flow model, can you? And they have this finger going like this, please step back, you're going to hurt me. And at the risk of grave personal injury, I would say, yes, you can value Amazon using a discounted cash flow model. And they'd give me this look of total contempt. Say, academic. The way they said it was not meant to be a compliment. It was basically, you really can't value any company, you can just talk about it. And after about the fifth time of being called an academic, I got really pissed off. I said, you know what, I'm going to try to value Amazon.com. First time I valued Amazon was in 1998. It's one of the few companies I valued every year since 1998, just because I'm fascinated by the company. And the first time I valued the company, here's what I did. I kept a journal of every roadblock I ran into in valuation. And I wrote in the journal to show you how many roadblocks I ran into. By the time I was finished with the valuation of Amazon in 1998, my journal was 75 pages long. I put it on my website as, hey, I did this, this is my journal. a publisher, I don't know which one, read, I think it was Prentice Hall, read it and said, would you want to make this a book? That became the basis for the Dark Side Evaluation. And everything I do with Young Company Valuation now, I learned in the process of valuing Amazon. Notice how I described it. I didn't know it going in. I just encountered it along the way. So I'm going to take you through a very early valuation of Amazon, because it's a company that all of you have seen kind of flourish in terms of market cap. And I'm going to take you back all the way to January 2000 and show you my valuation of Amazon as of January 2000. The advantage you have is you know what's happened since 2000. So you're going to say, that was wrong, that was wrong. You have the advantage in 2000. This is the peak of the NASDAQ boom then, the dot-com boom. The NASDAQ had just hit 5,000. Amazon was trading at $84. It was the one can't-miss stock that everybody had in their portfolios. Every investor had it. And I decided I wanted to sit down and value Amazon. So I'm going to take you through the valuation first, the full valuation, and then I'm going to take it apart in pieces so you can see where the numbers come from. So in January 2000, in the 12 months leading into January 2000, here's what Amazon reported. It reported revenues of $1.1 billion. Is that a lot of revenues? Let's get some perspective. You know what Walmart had as revenues last year? $300 billion. Costco is $50 billion. The gap is $12 billion. $1 billion is almost nothing. So it's a company with small revenues. And it had operating losses of $410 million. So it's a company with small revenues and big operating losses. Let me pause right there. Can a company with small revenues and big operating losses become a valuable company? If you say no, then you're never going to invest in a startup, right? Or let me reframe it. Can it? Can a company with small revenues and big operating losses become a valuable company?
Yeah, because you're looking at the future.
Exactly. So let's make it really simplistic. What has to happen to those small revenues? They have to become big revenues. You're saying this is so simplistic. Let's keep it simplistic. What has to happen to the losses? They have to become, not just shrink, they have to change signs, right? They have to become profits. Already you can see the first two big inputs I need for a young company are what? I need revenue growth to get the small revenues to big revenues, and I need a target margin, a positive number that I think they can get if they succeed. He's saying, what if I'm not an optimist? Don't value young startups. If you're one of those pessimistic people, why are you wasting your time? Every young startup is going to be worth zero to you because you're going to see doom. Something bad is going to happen. So put your optimist hat on. I'll let you bring out your pessimist hat later. So here are the first two big assumptions I made. Just to give you some perspective, this was actually a webcast that I did for AIMR, which is the parent organization for the CFA. It was one of their first live webcasts, very early technology webcasts. So I was doing the webcast, and people would email questions because they couldn't ask it directly. They would email questions. The guy would be thrusting the email questions in front of me while I was talking, extraordinarily distracting. So here was the first assumption I made. I assumed that Amazon's revenues would grow at 42% a year on a compounded basis for the next 10 years. I'll come and back up the 42%, but 42% a year compounded for the next 10 years. I hadn't even finished saying 42%. When the first email question comes in. How come you're being so pessimistic about future growth? What am I doing to the revenues? The $1 billion in revenues, by the end of year 10, I'm making them $40 billion. I'm increasing your revenue 40-fold. You know why it sounded pessimistic to him? What was he comparing the 42% to? The revenue growth in the most recent year, which was 200%, he said, how come you? What he missed was the compounded in the 10 years. I was actually not dropping the growth to 42% in year one. It was 150% in year two. But as the company got bigger, I had to start to scale down the growth rate, not because I was pessimistic about the company, but because of sheer math. Scaling up is hard to do. So I thought I was being pretty optimistic. My optimist hat is still on. So I'm making small revenues and big revenues. Half my problem is gone, right? I made the company into a big company. It's so easy to do this on a spreadsheet. Much more difficult if you have a real startup. Let's keep going. The second big assumption I made is I assumed that the target operating margin for Amazon would be 10%. You're saying, where do you get that number? That was actually the average pre-tax operating margin across brick-and-mortar retailers in 2000. You're saying, why didn't you just use dot-com retailers? Why didn't I? They were all losing money. There was nothing to look at there. I put in 10%. Second email question comes in. How come you're being so pessimistic about future margins? And there's actually a core of reason why they asked that, because there's a story going around about how dot-com retailers didn't need the physical infrastructure, brick-and-mortar retailers, therefore they should have lower costs. And you can see the next step. You have lower costs, your margin should be high. Let me ask you a question. Let's say retailing is a business. There are two ways of delivering the business. There's brick-and-mortar retailing, and there's online retailing. If this is steady state, you've now reached steady state, what should the margins look like for the two businesses? They have to be roughly the same, because if your margin in brick-and-mortar retailing is 10% and your margin in online retailing is 15%, what's every brick-and-mortar retailer going to start doing? They're going to say, why do I have brick-and-mortar? They're going to all go online. So I said, that's the argument I made. I said, if this is one business, the margins have to converge. The follow-up question was, why can't they converge at 15% rather than 10%? Why can't they? I know most of you are too young to think about retailing pre-online, but if I wanted to buy a computer 20 years ago, and I walked into Best Buy, or I wanted to buy a printer, the salesman pointed to a printer and said, this is a great price. This is the best price you're going to get. Now, to do research on his claim, what would I have had to do? I'd have had to jump into my car and start driving around the city looking for other computer stores and actually find that same model. And I don't know whether you read this story, but 2 years ago, Best Buy started covering up those scan codes on the side of all printers and computers in their stores. You know why they were doing that? Because here's what people were doing. They were coming in with their iPhones, scanning the scan code, and checking out the price on Amazon. So when this guy said, this is the best price, the consumer was looking and said, no, 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 it's not the best price. I can get it for $50 less on Amazon. See where I'm going? When you have two ways now as a consumer of buying things, the power shifts to you. What does that mean for margins in the retail business? They're going to go down, not up, because there's more competition now. You have to cut prices because you can't do that facade of this is the best price. What are you going to do about it? So in my story, I'm actually being optimistic, assuming margins would stay intact at 10%. So I'm still on my optimistic page. High revenue growth, target margin of 10%. It doesn't happen overnight. I'm not going to make 10% margins right away. So I'll take you through the pathway of getting from their existing margin, which is abysmal, to the positive margin. There's one final loose end. Remember we talked about if you want to grow, you have to reinvest. Now, if it's a mature company, how do we make that link explicit? We looked at return on capital and reinvestment rates and said if you want to grow fast, you have to reinvest. That's what I started with Amazon. Very quickly, I ran into a roadblock. What kind of return on capital will Amazon have in 2000? It's going to be negative, a big negative number. What kind of reinvestment rate is Amazon going to have in 2000? Big reinvestment divided by a negative after tax, a big negative reinvestment rate. You think this is very convenient. Big negative times big negative is big positive. But if you put a big positive growth rate on a negative number, it's only going to get more negative over time. This is where I got stuck for almost a week trying to figure out how do you estimate reinvestment for a young growth company. And after about 2 weeks, I said, you know what? I have to connect it to revenues because revenues are the only positive number. It's really what the company is focused on. I have to tie how much you reinvest to what happens to your revenues. And that's when I concocted this ratio called the sales to capital ratio. So I looked at, for every dollar invested, how much sales do you get? And that number in early 2000 for Amazon was $3 for every dollar invested. You see where I'm going to go next? I took the change in revenue every year. So in year one, my revenue goes from $1.1 billion to $2.8 billion. That's an increase of about $1.7 billion. And to get the reinvestment in year one, I took the change in revenue and divided by three. Why three? Because I'm assuming I get $3 in revenues for every dollar of capital. And I did that for each year. That's where I get my reinvestment. Early on in this class, I said the more uncertain you get, the less detail you should build into your valuation. Now you're saying this reinvestment, it could be from net capex, it could be from change in working capital, it could be from infrastructure investment, it could be from acquisitions. Absolutely true. You're saying, why aren't you breaking them down? Why am I not breaking them down into those different components? Not only do I not know where they will come from, Jeff Bezos would not have known, right? This is, you're looking into the future. Only thing you know with absolute certainty is you'll have to reinvest a lot of money. And that's all I'm saying is, look, what do I care whether it's net capex or acquisitions? So that gives me my reinvestment every year. So by now, what have I done? I've made the small revenues into big revenues. I've made the losses into profits. I'm subtracting out my reinvestment. I've got my free cash flow to the firm. And this is my optimistic scenario. See why I called it my optimistic scenario? What are my free cash flows in year one? Minus 931 million. Year two, minus a billion. Year three, minus a billion. Year four, minus, minus, minus. Am I surprised? Not in the least. Why are the cash flows so negative? Because they're very ambitious about future growth. The more ambitious I get, the more negative my cash flows will become. But I am making an implicit assumption here that I should probably make explicit. Let me take year one. I have a free cash flow to the firm of minus 931 million, right? What am I assuming Amazon's going to be able to do in 2001? What do they have to do? What is that minus 931? I mean, that looks like just a number, minus 931. What am I implicitly assuming that they will be able to do in that year? They will have to raise new capital, right? In fact, I'm telling you exactly where they're going to raise capital, because if you look at my debt ratios for the first 5 years, it's 1% debt, 99% equity. So they will have to raise most of it from the equity market. I'm assuming capital markets will stay open and accessible for them to be able to go out and raise that money. Is that a safe assumption? In January 2000, I thought it was, because I was in the middle of a dot-com boom. I said, how difficult can it be for a dot-com company to raise capital? But you can see already why with startups you have to ask a follow-up question. What is the chance that something bad could happen to capital markets, in which case you could be exactly right in every single estimate you make? But in year three, when you go out to raise $1 billion, the capital markets shut down, what's going to happen to your company? Nirvana is not coming. You see what nirvana is? The terminal value. That's what's bailing you out. You have to get to year 10 to see nirvana. Year three, you can't make the cash flow. Somebody shuts your business down. They're going to pick you apart like vultures. You're not getting a terminal value. That is a worry you have with young startups that we will talk about explicitly bringing in. But in January 2000, I wasn't in the least bit phased. So I have my cash flows. I need a discount rate, right? I need a cost of capital. Let me be more specific, though. I'm not going to be able to get one cost of capital. Why? Because on my spreadsheet, what am I doing to Amazon? It's going from being a small money-losing company to a big money-making company. So let's hang in there. Small money-losing companies. First, what do you expect to see in terms of composition of capital? Where should they raise money? If you're a small money-losing company, would you raise equity or debt? If you try to borrow money, you're going to be shut down. So mostly equity, very risky equity or very safe equity? It's going to be very risky equity. So when you see your cost of capital in year one, it's going to be mostly equity, and it's going to be very risky equity. You're going to have high cost of equity and a high cost of capital. For Amazon, that's exactly what you see, 12.84%. By the time I get to year five, I'm giving them $19 billion in revenue and $1.6 billion profit. They're no longer a small money-losing company. They're a mid-sized money-making company. Stay in there with the intuition. Now they can borrow some money. Their equity is going to become less risky. What does it mean in terms of cost of capital? You should start to see the cost of equity start to come down. You should start to see the debt ratio start to go up. You should start to see the cost of capital starting to become smaller. So starting in year five, that's exactly what you see. Your cost of capital starts to drop. And by the time I get to year 10, the cost of capital for Amazon is down to 9.61%. I'm almost home. I have the cash flows. I have these costs of capital that change over time. I discount the cash flows back at those costs of capital. What I get as a present value, in fact, at the end of year 10, I put them into stable growth. I give them a 6% growth rate forever. That sounds incredibly high, right? But why am I able to get away with a 6% growth rate forever? What do you compare it to my T-bond rate? This is the U.S. Treasury bond rate in January 2000 was 6.5%. Different times, 6% would be. Today, if I used a 6% dollar growth rate, I'd be like the Tesla valuation guy, where I'd be all Tesla all the time. Here, I was able to get away with it. Do you think I've been pretty optimistic in this valuation? Small company becomes big, money losing company becomes money making. I've put in, you know, reinvestment like a retail firm. The value that I get for the operating assets is $14.9 billion. There's almost no cash and no debt. I net them out, I get a value for the equity of $14,587 million. We talked about equity options, how there is share of the equity. Look at how much of Amazon is gone. They've actually given away almost a quarter of the company in the form of options. How do you think this happens? What were the accountants saying about options pre-2007? If you grant options that are at the money, what did they say they were worth? Nothing. If you're giving away nothing, what's a million times nothing? Nothing. 10 million times nothing is nothing. So in the late 90s, that's what technology companies thought they were doing. They're saying options, they're at the money, they're free. I mean, you treated options as free currency. You went to a restaurant, you had a big meal, you didn't have money for a tip, you left an option. You let somebody come in and paint a mural in your building, you didn't have money to pay them, you gave them options. I'm not kidding. That's what happened. The guy at Facebook actually painted a mural in their original office, got these options, which when Facebook went public, made him a multimillionaire. I wish I'd been painting murals. Forget about this stuff. Right? But basically, you're paying for those options as a stockholder. I subtract out the value of the options and divide by the actual number of shares. The value per share is $34. So I'm going to end with a final question. Remember when I valued 3M at 84 and the stock was at 70? I asked you to ask me the question and you said, am I buying? And I said, yes, though it didn't work out that well in the next 2 months. Ask me the analogous question here. Did I sell short, right? Obviously, if I don't own it, I can't sell it. And my answer, and this is exactly what the last question I was asked in the webcast was, are you selling short? And I said, not in this lifetime. Ask me why. Come on, ask me explicitly. Why? Okay, good. Thank you for asking me that question. It's not because I don't feel more I actually feel more confident about Amazon being overvalued than 3M being undervalued. But what does selling short mean? You go out and borrow somebody else's shares and you sell them, right? I actually called around brokers in the week before this presentation. Said, can I sell short on Amazon? They said, sure. You know how much time they gave me? 6 weeks. They said, as long as you return the shares in 6 weeks. Now do you see why I didn't sell short? I feel confident in my valuation, but to make money, what has to happen? The market has to fix its mistakes in the next 6 weeks. I'm not even going there. This is one of the great asymmetries in investing. If you think something is cheap, there is a long-term stretch. It's buy and hold. There is no analysis. So if you think Snap is overpriced, don't do stupid things like selling short. You could go bankrupt. Of course, 5 years later, you can say, I was right about Snap, but that doesn't help you very much. You were bankrupt already. So be careful about overvalued stocks, because sometimes the best you can do is say, thank God I don't own that stock. So I will see you on Wednesday. Remember the value I got was $14.9 billion? Yeah. It would have been $20 billion without the negative cash flow for the first 6 years. So I'm actually building in almost a 20% dilution, a 30% dilution that's going to happen by building in those negative cash flows.
So it means that if you have a raise that means you have to be negative. Right? Like,
that's your only reason for raising it, right?
Okay.
You're covering that negative cash flow with the equity raise stuff.
So I was working on this auto company, and I did what do you call top-down growth instead of the bottom-up. I did my bottom-up first of all based on
from the revenue. So you started with revenue.
From the prototypes, right? A0, like different levels. But about it, then I realized I'm going to launch a new brand, and then there will be so many new models, and I cannot model it.
That's the reason you don't do it.
at the individual level, that's what you're going to run into. That's why I said you have to start with a story about the company, about their strategy, about introducing new models, and make that part of your revenue, overall revenue.
So what I did is I found the 97% sales in China, so Chinese, private vehicle broker in the Poland. Got it for the past 6 years, projected the next 10 years using I control the CAGR. That's what I use. Yeah. Like the world, it's not like emerging markets.
What market share are you giving them at the end?
The market share, I give it like 8% for the sedan.
It's like a pretty optimistic story, but it's an optimistic story. It's fine, right?
But right now, like Toyota is like 50% of the sedan market. Mm-hmm. So I think like they are eventually half of Toyota.
That's
like.
Fine. That's a reasonable story. What kind of margins are you giving them?
Oh, I'm sleeping on that. But
that's going to be the big part of your story, right? Because if they get this market share by cutting prices, then that's
part.
No, you don't have to do the pricing. You just have to tell me whether they're going to go after a discount strategy or what. Are they going to go after growth at any cost, right? So then you're going to be like Amazon. You're going to sell at cost. It's not. You don't even have to know the price. You just have to know their mindset. Is their mindset growth or is their mindset profit?
So am I using this growth rate applied to their revenue?
Exactly.
I thought this is for the volume.
Well, then you're talking about price per car, right?
So
that's fine. Then put in a price per car on something, but...
Okay, like a blended price. And
exactly.
Then, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Hello there.
Hi. Oh, yeah. So good, thank you. I was wondering how I'm a bit stuck on how to approach...
I'm going to post my valiant story tomorrow.
You will? Yeah. Okay, so I will have a...
So you can at least take a peek at my story. I think the story is broken. So I'm going to really put that into my story, but I'm going to explain why I'm still holding, because I think Bill Ackman leaving actually means that they're now freer to explore. Because as long as he was there, he wanted them to be a going concern.